This is Regionally Speaking on Lakeshore Public Radio. I'm Chris Nolte.
Robert McClory has been a student, a lawyer, a seminarian, a pastor, and a chancellor, and now he is taking on a new challenge as the fifth bishop of the Diocese of Gary. We have a chance to talk with Bishop Robert McClory about his impending appointment, the appointment, I should say, from Pope Francis, and his impending consecration and installation as the new bishop for the Diocese of Gary, which is coming up on February 11th, 2020. Bishop McClory, thank you for joining us on Regionally Speaking today.
It's a delight to be with you, Chris, and hearty hello and blessings to all your listeners.
Thank you very much. I've had an opportunity to take a look at some of the information about your background, not only personal background, but also, too, about your religious background. Tell us first, I guess, about yourself and the position that you are coming from there in Royal Oak, Michigan.
Yeah, so currently I serve as the pastor and the rector of the National Shrine of the Little Flower, which is a basilica in Royal Oak, Michigan. It's a large and vibrant parish. We have 4,500 families. We've got a beautiful and historical edifice, along with pre-K through 12 high school. So it's a wonderful place to serve the people of God, and hopefully it's prepared me to serve an even wider flock in Northwest Indiana.
I have a very extensive Catholic education, starting from grade school there in Detroit, and moving on to other schools as well. You moved on, I guess, into secular college, I understand. In fact, into a secular career. Tell us what prompted you to make the shift from college, and included attending University of Michigan and get a law degree and a practice in law, into, I guess, the calling for the priesthood.
Yeah, it's an excellent question. You know, even in my study of the law, and I had previously studied public policy with some interest in economic development, I always looked for ways to be of service, to try and make a contribution to the greater good. And so certainly that expressed itself in some interest in the law and public policy. And I think as my journey of faith continued to grow, what I realized is that the most important thing that I can give people is really the loving outreach that God wants us all to give. And so I began to reflect more fully on what God might be calling me to, and certainly I think he uses all of our background, and so my background in law and in public policy hopefully will serve as well as I'm in a pastoral role in the Diocese of Gary. But that motivation just continued to grow and express itself, and I thought, if I gave myself completely to serving Jesus in the ministry, I think that's really the best way that God would use me to have an impact on the lives of others.
When you took up the priesthood, was ordained as a priest in May of 1999, did you have any thought at all about the possibility that you would end up being a bishop?
I did not. You know, this is something that just comes suddenly, and your life has changed in an instant. And so, really, I had no idea until I received a phone call from someone called the Papal Nuncio. It's like the Pope's ambassador to the United States, but also his delegate to the Church in the United States. And he called me up and said, "The Holy Father has appointed you the Bishop of Gary." And I said, I knew it was Gary. He said, "Gary." I said, "I am delighted." And I said, "If that's the Holy Father's wishes, I'll be happy to fulfill that." I said, "I don't think I'm worthy, but if the Holy Father wants me, then I'll do my best." And so he was very grateful for that, and my life was suddenly changed, and all changed for the good. The people of Gary have been so loving and kind and supportive, and the people of the region that I've had a chance to encounter have genuinely given me the love and embrace, which I'm very grateful for.
One of the things I noticed in getting ready for our conversation was that it's interesting that you, being the Bishop of McClory, will be, when your ordination happens here in February, as actually going to be Gary's second bishop with some Detroit ties. You being a native of Detroit and the region and in Michigan, it's interesting that Bishop Dale Melchick, who was the bishop previous to you back, was also involved in the priesthood in Detroit.
Yes, and for me that's been just a tremendous blessing. Over the years I've had the opportunity to meet and converse with Bishop Melchick on several occasions. He certainly had an excellent reputation in Detroit for his service here, and then, you know, from afar, not too far away, Detroit and Gary aren't that far away, the opportunity to just really appreciate and admire all that he's done there. One of the special blessings that the timing of my announcement as the bishop was just before something called an ad limina visit, which is a visit of the bishops of a particular region to Rome to meet with the Pope and also to pray at some of the holy sites. So during that occasion, which was a week in Rome, I was with Bishop Melchek during that time, as well as Bishop Donald Haying, who had immediately succeeded Bishop Melchek for the last 5.5 years. And so that was a wonderful way to be kind of welcomed into the fraternity that is in Gary.
Had you had the chance ever to visit Vatican City in the past, or was that your first visit?
Well, it was my the first time that I met Pope Francis. I did study in Rome, so I was there for 5 years. During that time, it would have been St. John Paul II. So it was a real treat to be able to meet Pope Francis, and not just meet him, but we were in a setting where he meets with groups of bishops. So there were about 25 of us bishops from Indiana, Illinois, and Wisconsin. And we had about a two-and-a-half-hour meeting with Pope Francis, which was a real delight.
In the transition here from being involved in the diocese and archdiocese in Detroit, coming to become the bishop of the Diocese of Gary, are there any similarities? Are there any differences between the two?
Well, I'd like to think that there are. I, you know, certainly don't want to presume Gary's history to some significant degree. I'll be welcomed, and that'll become my new home very shortly. But I think, to the extent that we're both, you know, part of the industrial Great Lakes, that there are some commonalities. Certainly the presence of a dominant industry that experienced some transformation and some periods of economic downturns, both in Detroit, heavily reliant on the auto industry, and of course Gary, historically identified with the steel industry. Our communities can be highly sensitive to economic fluctuations and also, you know, the dislocation that can occur when such economic downturns take place. So having that experience, I hope, will give me a sense of compassion and understanding as I come to Gary. But I would also say, you know, I'm a healthily proud son of Detroit, and I will be a proud son of Gary. And I think sometimes those communities, perhaps, that have had some similar struggles can almost begin to feel a little bit like we're marginalized, and that's certainly not God's plan. God's love is for all of us. And even if, you know, the rest of the world doesn't know all the gifts that we have, we know the gifts that we have. And so I really hope to bring a message of encouragement and hopefulness and God's love. And I think some of my experience in Detroit may be transferable into Gary, just having a kind of a sensitivity to what it means to be in communities that have gone through those changes and struggles and come out for the better, ultimately, because of it.
Are there any special plans that, in the meantime, that you have thought about between the time that the announcement came out in November and your impending ordination and installation as the bishop? Anything special that you have maybe in mind for the folks here of the Diocese of Gary?
Well, this has been a real time of information gathering for me, of course, planning some of the logistics of the liturgy itself that will be occurring. But as I look beyond February 11th, there are probably about three areas that I think would be good for me to focus on, three or four. I mean, initially, as I said, just being a presence of hope and encouragement. We're in the midst of finalizing a public schedule so that after the 11th, I'll be having the opportunity to have masses or opportunities to be at some significant events throughout the four counties. Beyond that would be really to get to know the needs of the flock in Gary so that I can listen and I can receive and get a deeper appreciation for what the people of Gary might need and want at this time. The third area that I'm very privileged to be able to build upon is that Bishop Haying in 2017 had what's called a diocesan synod, and that's a pretty rare occurrence in the life of a diocese. And so that was a convening of leaders and a time of reflection for the whole Diocese of Gary that occurred in 2017. And so that laid forth some pastoral priorities, some areas that we need to focus on in terms of evangelization and service to others. And so I feel as though that will give me a foundation to be able to reach out and have some guideposts as I begin to minister. And then finally, of course, I'm coming as the Catholic bishop, the Roman Catholic bishop, to the Diocese of Gary, but I also see myself as having a responsibility to be a good member of the wider community, to make sure that people understand that the Catholic Church, whether you're Catholic or not, whether you have another faith or no faith, that we exist to bring to be good neighbors, to bring God's love, and to do our part in the wider community. So that's also something that I see as significant when I come into Gary.
Well, Bishop Robert McClory, thank you very much for speaking with us, and we look forward to having a chance to meet you when you do make your visit and become the new bishop of the Diocese of Gary on February 11th. Thank you for spending some time talking today.
Thank you so much, Chris.
Even though there are concerns from some that immigrants drive down wages and hinder the economy, a report from Ball State University shows that these newcomers have a positive impact on the Hoosier State. The author of the study is Emily Warnell, and she was with us on Regionally Speaking to talk about it.
It's really important to us that we got our data collection from publicly available data sources and really the best data sources that we could find from the federal government. Because this is such a strong political and social conversation, having the very best data available and data that other people can see was of utmost importance to us. So I think the most important kind of takeaway from this is that immigration is more complicated than it typically is talked about in social and political discussions. Mm-hmm. And what we find really is that immigration generally is acting as a source of population stability to a lot of rural communities. Now, we look just specifically at Indiana, but this is really true nationally as well in the research that I've done previously, that there are a lot of immigrants going to rural communities that are otherwise losing population. So it really should be seen as a potential source of population growth in these places.
In putting all the information together, did you notice if the increase in immigration here in Indiana is something that is just a sudden burst of activity, or has this been something that has been following a trend over the years?
Well, it depends on how long you consider a new trend or not. So really, this has been going on since the 1990s is when we really saw, the early 1990s is when we really saw an increase of immigration around the country in places that hadn't experienced a lot of immigration growth in the past. But we were looking specifically at the 2000 to 2015 years. And even with that, you know, only 25% of the population growth in Indiana was specifically due to increasing immigration. So it's a pretty significant rate, even more recently than 1990. And that rate continues to persist, or that increase continues to persist through today.
I know that the social media and the general media coverage, when it comes up to the topic of immigration and immigration reform, typically seems to focus on Hispanics. But that's not always the case. That I'm sure that you found in your research that not all the immigrants coming into Indiana, for that matter, are coming from, say, even Mexico.
Yeah, that's right. And it really depends on the region of the state that you're looking at. It depends on the state that you're looking at. And obviously, we're looking at Indiana. But even within, you know, Indianapolis, for example, there are immigrants coming from all over the world. And we do largely talk about immigration coming from Central and Latin America. That remains the largest group of immigrants coming into the U.S. and into Indiana generally. But we have a lot of immigration coming from Asia as well, particularly because of our high-tech industry. And our medical services and our university systems, there's a lot of immigrants from other parts of the world than just Latin America.
What did you folks look into to get your data together, and what have you found that's in the report about how immigrants in Indiana seem to be on education?
I think, like with most of the topics, the takeaway is that it is much more complicated than the national debate would have us believe. So typically when people are talking about education, there is an assumption that immigrants are coming to the U.S. with fairly low levels of education and human capital in general. And we found that overall, when you look at all of the immigrants in Indiana, they tend to be better educated than native-born Hoosiers. But that really depends on where they're coming from, their home countries. And it also, even though there is a much larger segment of the immigrant population that has a college degree or greater, there is also a much larger segment that has less than a high school degree. So it really is pretty bifurcated in what we're looking at in terms of educational attainment. That said, however, when you look at immigrants coming who have come to the United States since 2010, mm-hmm. Their rates of educational attainment are much higher than either the native-born population or immigrants that came to the United States prior to 2010, which indicates to us that immigrants coming into the United States more recently are more educated than those who had been in the United States previously.
Does this in turn have an impact not only on family members, but also on the school systems?
Sure. So we did look at that a little bit as well. There is a fear among some that having more, for example, English language learners in a primary secondary school system is going to drive down educational outcomes for that entire school. And the idea being that, you know, more resources need to be diverted to helping English language learners. There's more money, there's more time going into those, and so there's not as many resources for the traditional classroom setting. And we looked at the ISTEP results, and we really found, both in terms of the percentage of students that are English language learners and the number of students that are English language learners, there is not an impact on educational outcomes for schools that have high rates of English language learners in them. But in universities, you could also argue that there is a benefit to having immigrants as well, because we have a lot of immigrants in our university systems. The U.S. still is one of the best educational systems for post-secondary education, and people want to come to the U.S. to study. And so if immigrants were not in the country or not allowed to be in the country or needed to go home, that would have a really dramatic and long-lasting impact on our university system.
That's Ball State University researcher Emily Warnell, and the full report is on the BSU Center for Business and Economic Research website. You're listening to Regionally Speaking here on listener-supported Lakeshore Public Radio. It's time once again for another edition of Green Fleet Radio, and here's your host, Carl Lissick.
Well, good day. Today, our guest is Mr. Sean Seals. He's the Senior Environmental Manager for the Indiana Department of Environmental Management. Sean, welcome back to the show.
Thank you, Carl.
So, Sean, we've talked a lot on this program about the Indiana Volkswagen Environmental Mitigation Trust. Can you remind our listeners of IDEM's role and what the program entails?
Well, sure. As you might recall, IDEM was designated as the beneficiary to administer the Volkswagen Environmental Mitigation Trust Fund program for the state of Indiana. IDEM works in partnership with the governor-appointed Indiana Volkswagen Environmental Mitigation Trust Fund Committee, who make key decisions within that statewide program.
IDEM Commissioner Bruno Pickett was on the show back in October and provided an overview of the first round of awards. Where are we in terms of the rollout of these projects that received the first round of funding?
IDEM was thrilled to receive over 60 high-quality applications in round one of the on-road and non-road program. Due to the availability of funding, though, we were only able to award 34 projects from this list. All of these projects are currently being implemented and include projects that include replacing school buses, some with CNG powered, some are electric, replacing transit buses, replacing refuse haulers, garbage trucks as they are commonly known, as well as local delivery vehicles, to name just a few. We're very excited to see these projects progress, and we're really looking forward to round two of this program, which should be coming out in the very near future.
So, Sean, South Shore Clean Cities was pleased to participate in the EV charging infrastructure workshop back in October that the committee held. I know you recently accepted public comments on that portion of the program. Can you give our listeners a little update on that?
Absolutely. First, we want to say we were very thankful to have South Shore Clean Cities support in developing the EV charging infrastructure workshop last year. And we were able to share a lot of good information with the participants at the event. The workshop, for your reference, was recorded and is available on the Volkswagen website at www.idem.in.gov/VW Trust, in case you wanted to take a look. IDEM recently received about 30 unique comment submissions in response to our request for information on Indiana's EV charging infrastructure. Generally speaking, the responses we received indicate a strong desire to have a statewide EV charging network that incorporates both direct current fast charger and level 2 charging stations. It is our plan to publish a request for proposals on this program in the coming months, with awards hopefully coming out in the fall or winter of this year.
Well, that's exciting. I know the recent IDEM Diesel Wise with DARA option awards were just recently approved by the committee last month, which was obviously exciting also. Can you explain what kinds of projects those awards funds were and how we can expect to see some of those projects here in northern Indiana?
Sure. We are planning to fund, and the Volkswagen Committee on last Friday did approve five high-quality projects that have significant emission reduction potential and air quality improvements across four Indiana counties. These projects include replacements of diesel-powered terminal trucks, which operate all day moving trailers around a warehouse with electric-powered alternatives. We're also replacing a diesel-powered switcher locomotive with an all-electric rail car mover, and two projects that will reduce older diesel-powered landfill compactors and front-end loaders with new clean diesel-powered alternatives. Several of these projects actually are here in northern Indiana. One of the terminal tractor truck projects will be implemented in Newton County. And the locomotive to electric railcar mover project is also going to be up here in Porter County, as well as a rubber-tired front-end loader also out there at the port. The end result will be lower emissions from all of this equipment and a really highly better quality of life for those that live in the areas surrounding them.
So I know we were talking about the next round of grant funding, so round two. When do you expect that to come out? And are there any changes from the first round, a request for proposals that we'll see in the second round?
Yeah, those are actually really great questions, Carl. Thanks for asking. We are currently hoping to post round two of the Volkswagen on-road and non-road program to the Volkswagen website either this month or next. After every round of funding, IDEM revisits the RFPs to identify potential areas of improvement. Overall, this program is expected to be pretty similar to round one, but some of the minor changes deal with the scoring criteria. Things such as contingency funding, hours of operation for non-road equipment, and a more focused program when it comes to diesel-to-diesel replacement projects. So I would say these are the areas where applicants in round two should pay particular attention when the RFP is posted to determine how they may impact their applications.
So, Shawna, you're talking a lot about different awards, different projects that are coming out. So how can our listeners learn more about the Indiana Volkswagen Environmental Trust Agreement?
Another great question, and probably the easiest and best way to keep up to speed with the latest information on the Indiana Volkswagen Mitigation Trust Program would be to visit our Volkswagen Program website. I referenced it earlier, but possibly an easier way to find it is to just Google Indiana Volkswagen Trust Program. Should be one of the top things that you'll see in the results. Now, when you visit that website, you will have the opportunity to sign up for automated emails so that anytime updates are made to the website, you will receive an email letting you know that there has been a change to the site. By signing up for these updates, you'll always know when funding opportunities or other important announcements are posted.
Well, Sean, any closing thoughts as we come to the end of our program?
No closing thoughts other than we continue to be very excited about what we've seen in round one for the on-road and non-road program, as well as round one of the DERA option program. We're really excited to see what round two holds for both of these components of the Volkswagen program, as well as the statewide EV infrastructure program that we're getting ready to roll out.
Well, Sean, as always, thank you for all you do for the state and quality of air here in not only Northwest Indiana, but the state of Indiana. And that will do it for today's edition of Green Fleet Radio. Thank you again to Sean Seals, Senior Environmental Manager for the Indiana Department of Environmental Management. Green Fleet Radio airs three times each Wednesday on Lakeshore Public Radio. I'm your host, Carl Lissick. Thanks for joining us. And remember, it's never too late to begin your environmental legacy.
Green Fleet Radio is made possible by South Shore Clean Cities and the Northwestern Indiana Regional Planning Commission. You can hear Green Fleet Radio every Wednesday here on Regionally Speaking on Lakeshore Public Radio, 89.1 FM. And the podcasts are also found, too, on our website, lakeshorepublicradio.org. On this approaching Valentine's Day, you may, of course, consider giving your loved one some flowers or perhaps some chocolates, but what about a gift that you can give that would last forever? And we don't mean diamonds either. Financial security is one of those that will last forever, and to find out more about that and some of the things you need to do to be able to provide it for your spouse, your loved one, we talk with Northwest Indiana financial advisor Greg Hammer about it. And Greg, thanks for joining us on Regionally Speaking today.
Thanks for having me on, Chris.
Well, it's always something that I guess will make people feel more confident about the family's future, and be able to plan better for the future. But there are a few important tips to take, and let's talk about these. One in particular is one that maybe just seems pretty obvious, but for some it may be or maybe not obvious, is saving more money. Tell us more about that.
Yeah, as you mentioned, it's pretty self-evident, but it bears repeating. The more you can set aside today for savings, then the sooner you can start, the more secure you're going to be in the future, especially with company programs. If you have the opportunity to contribute where there's matching dollars, we always tell people it's free money. Make sure you're taking advantage of it. And if you don't have plans, look at different avenues like traditional IRAs and Roth IRAs where you can contribute individually and still take advantage of, but taxes and contributing in the savings that could provide value for the future.
I suppose, too, even for that matter, if you talk about having the money available from your employer and it is part of what you're paid in some way or another, that you ought to at least try and get as much as you can get for a match, huh?
Yeah, absolutely. Most companies will do some level of matching, not always 100%, but, any contribution that you can make is at a matching basis, it just makes sense, right? It's very logical. But in the 401k structure, especially depending if you're over age 50, you can contribute a number of dollars that you just can't do on an individual basis. So company plans are a great place, not only for larger dollar amounts, but very cost effective from a fee standpoint as well.
One of the other areas I know that we should probably think more about if we're trying to be able to provide this financial security that we want to make is find a way to get your taxes down as low as you can get them.
Yep. Reducing taxes is always a conversation we like to have. I always tell people it's not what you make, it's what you get to keep. And you can do tax planning today to reduce the impact on your return. But I think the most significant planning when it comes to reducing taxes is working with a professional to understand how they work. And as you move into savings and retirement, how those assets are accumulated, what the impact will be on your future retirement income. So if you have a significant amount of dollars in qualified plans, you need to understand the distribution rules, and taxes do work differently in distribution. You can control taxable events. There's things that occur based on how you set up your distribution plan that could be avoided and save you a lot in taxes.
Now we talk about being able to reduce taxes and taking advantage of whatever options you have. Is this something that obviously you can probably do, although we think about it more, I guess, around income tax return time, something that you probably should plan any time of the year?
Yeah, absolutely. And the more proactive you can be in it in the planning process, especially when you consider things like Roth conversions, those are not specifically around tax preparation time. It's things that could occur throughout the year. In fact, a lot of conversions might be better served at different times outside of the tax preparation period.
Are these opportunities maybe you could even take, certainly the first of the calendar year, if you want to try and beat opportunities, take advantage of the opportunities rather that are there and try and beat the deadlines?
Yeah, I mean, the biggest thing when it comes to understanding where and how you can reduce taxes is to get an idea of what your distribution plan is going to look like, because Social Security could be affected by how much you take out. Capital gains could be affected by how much you take out. Dividends could be affected by how much you take out. And structuring your plan the way to pay taxes in what I consider a very favorable tax table with the new laws, especially with some of the changes with the Secure Act and the elimination of things like the stretch IRA, planning is even more relevant than it has been in the past.
I know I want to get to the question of Social Security in just a moment, too. But Greg, I know that during this time of year in particular with Valentine's Day, there's a lot of emotion involved. Hopefully it's good emotion. But the idea is that when it comes to financial security to help make the holiday meaning a lot stronger and for the rest of your life, I suppose, for that matter, you should take that emotion out. That's a pretty important part.
Yeah, absolutely. Because if you're looking at the market every day and deciding where and how to get in and out of the market, history has proven that that's a very, very difficult way to accumulate assets. Efficiency of the markets long term has a proven track record, and it's all about proper time horizons and making sure that your allocations match your risk tolerance and having correct expectations. We know the market's going to be volatile. It has been forever. And even though we've been on an incredible up run in the market, we should expect that things will be volatile again in the future, and just be prepared and understand that we don't panic. Don't let emotions force decisions that could be detrimental to the process.
We're talking with Northwest Indiana financial advisor Greg Hammer about some of the things we should keep in mind to help make Valentine's Day is an important one beyond just the gifts that we give on the particular day. We're talking about the financial security for a spouse, for the family as well. And Social Security is one of these areas I know that you need to take a look at. And I suppose you could even take a look at this even in your younger years before you approach retirement. But it's more important even then, isn't it?
Yeah, it's critical in the planning process because everybody needs to understand how Social Security is reportable for tax purposes. And there's a direct equation called provisional income that determines whether or not Social Security is going to be taxable or not taxable. And depending on when or how you collect it, it could create a bigger tax burden on distributions from your qualified plans. So the analysis for maximizing your Social Security should go beyond just the whole number analysis because, again, refer back to the taxes. It's not how much we're getting, it's how much we get to keep. And depending on some of the concerns and priorities, Social Security can help address things that investments simply cannot.
Do we find sometimes that if you plan properly as far as your Social Security benefit going out in your time is important or maybe more so than some of these other things we talk about, in particular being able to make that transition into retirement easier?
Yeah, I think Social Security is an integral part because statistically, for most families, it represents a very significant part of their retirement income. So once you make that election, it is final. You know, you don't have a do-over, so to speak, unless it's something that's done in that first 12 months. But essentially, when you look at Social Security, how it will address certain concerns. And, you know, it goes even from simple things like volatility. You know, Social Security is not dependent on how investments perform or how markets perform. It's a very good tool to address, you know, spend down of assets because it can provide income for a surviving spouse. So there's a lot more to the election and the optimization. And ultimately, by determining your plan, your income plan, you can better address the decision process and make decisions that are logical to address more concerns and priorities than just choosing to elect on a random selection basis.
Well, finally, Greg, let's talk about insurance. We haven't talked about that yet, and proper insurance coverage is very, very important if you want to provide that financial security blanket for yourself and for your family.
Well, exactly, and I can pretty much make the statement, I don't think anybody really likes insurance. Nobody likes paying for it, mm-hmm. But it's one of those things that, you know, we never want it till we need it, and when we need it, we generally can't get it. But as you're looking to protect things, I always tell people insurance is an act of love. You know, it's about the people that are left behind. And while there's different needs while we're younger, there's needs that arise in the future as we move into retirement in a survivor situation to protect assets against things like, you know, spend down from assisted care or long-term care needs. So there's different ways to address it. They're constantly coming out with new evolutions and new plans, and it's just part of that overall holistic planning process.
See, we managed to talk about Valentine's Day, and we only mentioned flowers and candy, a couple times maybe. I suppose we focus more on financial security, and we thank you very much for spending the time with us to go over these points and hope some folks got some tips out of all of that today.
Thanks, Chris.
That's a Northwest Indiana financial advisor, Greg Hammer. Here in Indiana, lawmakers, hospital administrators, and parents have raised concerns over the way that children on Medicaid are receiving mental health treatment. They say that state policy is producing a revolving door of children that need help. It could be more costly as well as dangerous. Side Effects Public Media's Carter Barrett has more for us in this piece about what's being done to change that.
We will now proceed with testimony on Senate Bill 192.
Standing at the podium in the Senate chambers, Dr. Darla Hinshaw spoke about the children she sees as a psychiatrist. One was a foster care teenager who was admitted into a facility on a Friday.
He continued to be aggressive. He punched walls, easily irritated into aggression.
By Sunday, the teen had started on new medication.
So on Monday, when we can reach the insurance companies, they stated they'd no longer cover his care because he wasn't saying that he wanted to kill himself, and he hadn't insulted anybody for 24 hours.
So the facility released him. This is the scenario that has sparked concern. A child or teen is admitted for a short-term stay at a mental health facility. After 3 days, including weekends, hospitals must ask Medicaid insurers to pay for additional days. And they say that's frequently denied. So the young patients are discharged if hospitals or parents won't cover the cost.
So the colors, as you notice throughout, like, and you can see down the hallway, every unit's a different color. And even the offices, it's not that dark, dingy, what everyone thinks mental health is, hospital. So
we're at Harsha Behavioral Center in Terre Haute, which has floor-to-ceiling windows and courtyards. That inviting atmosphere is exactly what CEO Rupam Harshavat intended.
There's so much dysfunction in their families that you can't even imagine where these children, they have been sexually abused at a very young age or they have been physically abused.
Harshavat says over the last several years, Medicaid insurers have approved fewer additional days for these young patients.
When these kids are discharged prematurely, they come right back. And the readmission rates are very high because of that.
In Indiana, four companies provide health coverage for Medicaid patients via a contract with the state. The companies declined to make someone available for an interview.
The bottom line is, you know, if these kids are not treated early, you can prevent addiction as adults. You can prevent them from becoming convicts or relying on government benefits for the rest of their lives.
In Evansville, Hospital Administrator Scott Branham says 3 days is often not enough time to assess, diagnose, and treat patients. He says at his clinic, Deaconess Cross Point, additional days are much more likely to be denied if patients are insured via Medicaid as opposed to commercial insurance.
We're using the same physicians, the same criteria, the same reviewers, the same medical record, but it's yielding much different results. When we make that request for a few extra days.
Yet, Branham says nearly 90% of Medicaid patients are denied additional days. This figure includes adults and children. Only about 2% of commercially insured patients are denied additional days there. The Family and Social Services Administration says state-contracted Medicaid insurers already allow these young patients to exceed the 3-day minimum stay. The agency says the average length of stay in a mental health facility for someone under 18 is 6 days. Now, Indiana lawmakers are looking for solutions. One proposal would allow young Medicaid recipients to stay 5 business days at a mental health facility before insurers can request a review. The bill unanimously passed the Senate and has moved to the House. For Side Effects Public Media, I'm Carter Barrett.
The country's newest national park isn't like many of the others. It's surrounded by some of the largest industrial companies in the nation, maybe even the world. And while Indiana Dunes' new designation that came in this past year has drawn a lot of national attention, so have the recent industrial spills in nearby Lake Michigan, the waterways. Indiana Public Broadcasting's Rebecca Thiel spent some time visiting last year, and she takes up the question, will the park's designation pressure the industrial companies to literally clean up their act?
Walking along the park's west beach, you wouldn't expect to see a lot of tourists on a weekday afternoon. But since Indiana Dunes became a national park in February, its visitor center has seen more people than it has in any of the past 8 years. But just 6 months later, excess cyanide and ammonia leaked from a nearby steel facility owned by ArcelorMittal, killing about 3,000 fish and forcing one park beach to close temporarily. After that, some tourists weren't sure the dunes were safe. That affected businesses in the area, like Spring House Inn, a small, woodsy retreat at the edge of the park. Kara Howard manages the front desk.
We had a lot of cancellations on reservations, and we had a lot of people who were calling and inquiring about if everything was affected by the chemical spill here at the dunes.
Howard says the inn expects to book nearly all of its rooms on the weekends, but after the spill, it was only about half full. But it's not just tourism at risk when these spills happen. The dunes have some of the most diverse types of plants and animals in the U.S., including many vulnerable species. Now that the dunes are a national park, environmentalists say there's even more reason to protect it. Natalie Johnson is the executive director of the environmental group Save the Dunes. She says when the Port of Indiana was founded in the 1960s, it was supposed to show how you could have a sensitive ecosystem like the dunes alongside pollution-free industry.
And are we pollution-free? The answer is absolutely not.
Some say industrial companies in the Great Lakes Basin are already working hard to be good stewards of the environment. Kay Nelson is the Environmental Affairs Director for the Northwest Indiana Forum, a regional economic development organization.
The discharge permits for any and all entities surrounding all five of the Great Lakes have much more stringent standards for their municipal and industrial discharge facilities than, say, the rest of the state of Indiana that does not discharge into Lake Michigan. So those limits are already very stringent.
But environmentalists say industry isn't doing enough. According to the Environmental Protection Agency, U.S. Steel and ArcelorMittal are among the top five companies for most toxic releases in Indiana since 2007. And per square mile, Indiana has the third highest toxic releases in the country. A parks advocacy group, the National Parks Conservation Association, says industrial air pollution, along with emissions from nearby Chicago, are likely having an effect on the plants and animals at the dunes. Colin Deverell is the NPCA's Midwest Program Manager.
Visitors to national parks expect a certain experience. You expect clean air, you expect clean water, you expect natural vistas.
And Deverell says there should be consequences for companies that pollute the park. Back when Indiana Dunes was just known as a national lakeshore, U.S. Steel spilled about 300 pounds of the cancer-causing chemical hexavalent chromium into the Burns waterway, which feeds into Lake Michigan. The EPA still hasn't finalized a consent decree, which means the company has yet to pay fines for harm caused by the spill.
But what's really needed is that added layer of vigilance. Vigilance from people who come to national parks to say, we expect that clean air, we expect that clean water. So businesses, state and federal regulators, do your jobs and protect this place.
Two environmental groups say they'll sue ArcelorMittal if state and federal regulators don't hold the company accountable for its environmental violations. We could not get an interview with the Northwest Indiana industrial companies, U.S. Steel, BP, or ArcelorMittal. For Indiana Public Broadcasting, I'm Rebecca Thiel.
The Indiana Commission for Higher Education has unveiled its latest strategic plan, and Indiana Public Broadcasting's Jeannie Lindsay has more on the direction that Indiana is headed for learners beyond high school.
Commissioner of Higher Education Teresa Lubbers has long highlighted higher education's role in Indiana's workforce needs. And at this year's annual address, her message focused on how higher education has to change with an increasingly diverse state. She says, for one, people need more avenues to earn credentials.
The new economy will demand educational upgrades throughout life, and higher education must be more agile and relevant to meet this need.
Lubber says starting this year, the commission will focus on enhancing equity, completion rates, and developing talent. The commission will release an annual report card to track the agency's progress on its goals, including getting 60% of Hoosiers to earn a credential by 2025. For Indiana Public Broadcasting, I'm Jeannie Lindsay.
And that's it for Regionally Speaking for today. I'm Chris Nolte. Thank you for joining us. Coming up tomorrow on the program, we have, of course, with our Reporters Roundtable, Dan Carden and Joseph Pete with the Times of Northwest Indiana and Carol Carlson with the Post Tribune, and also a conversation with Assistant Valparaiso University Police Chief Chuck Garber. He is organizing this year's annual Polar Plunge for Special Olympics Indiana. It's going to happen this weekend at Valparaiso University, and we hope you'll find something and information about that. Another event that you may want to check out this weekend as well, too, here in Northwest Indiana. And we'll talk about it more on Regionally Speaking tomorrow.